Are we? We're on Blog Talk Radio. We're on Radio Suzy One on drsusanblock.com. And we're in your ear. Brothers and sisters, lovers and sinners, artists and exhibitionists, voyeurs and connoisseurs, all you children of sex, and we are all children of sex. We may or may not be children of God, Jesus, Allah, Buddha, or Brahma Ramadama, but until we start cloning ourselves, we are all children of sex, with a capital X. And sex is what we talk about here on the Dr. Susan Block Show on Radio Suzy One. And sex, of course, is the essence of life, the center of the storm, the opposite of death, for the most part, although sex and death sometimes go together. We talk about sex, love, life, and death here on Radio Suzy One. I am Susie, Dr. Susan Block, your love doctor, your pleasure preacher. And I'm broadcasting live from the Speakeasy in the soul of downtown L.A., where I'm surrounded by the Speakeasy crew, the Bonobo Gang, madly tweaking their controls and coming to you from the soul of downtown L.A. We have Brother Joe.
Hello, hello.
Hey, Brother Joe. How's it going?
Pretty good, actually.
On the master controls, our engineer. And Sister Terry is here with us.
Hello, hello.
Good evening, Sister Terry. How are you doing tonight?
Quite well, thank you.
And we have a special guest, the author of a fabulous erotic novel called The Amorous Woman. Her name is Donna George Story. Welcome to the Dr. Susan Block Show, Donna.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we're so glad to have you. I have been enjoying your book tremendously. This is a this is an erotic novel, I guess we would call it that.
Very much so, yes.
And it's got all the aspects of a novel with very compelling characters and a story and lots of emotion and lots of feeling. And it's also got a lot of hot, very explicit sex.
That was my intention. I'm glad to hear you think it's hot.
You succeeded.
Good.
Heated me up, that's for sure.
Yeah, I was reading over some of it. It's definitely steamy. I was entranced.
Yes, and it's not only steamy, but it's very interesting from a cultural perspective because it's mostly set in Japan.
Yes.
Modern
mm-hmm.
Japan,
mm-hmm.
With a little bit of old-fashioned Japan thrown in there.
Right.
And well, it just makes it all the more exotic for us Americanos.
Yeah, I think so. It's always interesting to see how another culture sort of adds its special flavor to sexuality. I find that interesting as well.
So what inspired you to write this novel, The Amorous Woman, set in Japan? Had you been to Japan?
Yes, actually. I lived in Japan for 3 years, went there right after I graduated from college.
Mm-hmm.
As a fresh young thing, rather like the protagonist in my novel.
Right.
And was just fascinated by the country. I really fell in love with it. So I lived there for 2 years and had some interesting experiences.
Now, you fell in love with the country. Did you fall in love with as many men as the protagonist in your novel?
Not quite as many, but
a few.
Yeah. A handful or two. And then
Japanese men.
Yes, mostly. The novel is somewhat autobiographical, so my protagonist Lydia has adventures with Japanese men and also some American men, and that's
mm-hmm.
sort of pretty much like my experience as well. And then I decided I wanted to learn more of the language, and living there, I didn't really have as much opportunity, so I came back here to grad school, and that's when I discovered a fascinating erotic novel from the 17th century, 17th century Japan, Ihara Saikaku's The Life of an Amorous Woman. And I was fascinated by that because it follows a woman's very bold sexual adventures. and I used that as the plot inspiration for my novel, and then mixed that in with my own personal experiences and my own fantasies and sexual sensibility.
Yeah, it's got a lot of sexual sensibility, that's for sure. It's very very personal. Has a very personal feel, and you just get sucked into it like any good novel, and then there's all that hot sex you can jill off to, or jerk off, as the case may be.
And I try to include a wide variety of possibilities in terms of the sexual themes.
Yes, and we're going to get into those wide variety of sexual scenes in a few moments. I want to give out the phone numbers in case you'd like to call in. Our number is 213-749-1330, and you can call that number, and you can talk with our guest, Donna George Story. You can talk with me, Dr. Susie, Sister Terry, Brother Joe. That number is 213-749-1330. And I think we have someone who wants to talk to the guest on the line, Raul from Pacoima. Do we? Yeah?
Let's find out.
Line two?
Line two. Nobody.
Well, apparently not.
Oh, I have a note saying Raul from Pacoima wants to talk to the guest. Okay. Well, I'll talk to the guest. All right, guest. Donna.
Yes.
Tell me, what is your kind of... how would you describe Japanese sexuality? Can it be described?
Yes. Well, I would start by saying that Japanese society in general is really a very contextual sort of thing. So where you are and what's going on around you, the people you're with, tends to decide your behavior and what you say and do. And so in my novel, you'll see, for example, that Lydia is involved with her husband-to-be in public. He's cold, formal. You wouldn't know he's actually an interesting person to have sex with. But once they get behind closed doors and they can be themselves, they can tap into that, the heat between them, he turns into a completely different person, very creative, very loving, and really good in bed. So when they're outside, you would not suspect that he would be an interesting person, but in their little world, he is. So there's that. I think we tend to see the Japanese as very formal and so forth, but I discovered in, you know, when you're alone, it's a very different experience. So I think in America, we tend to be more of the same wherever we are. And that's also true in the sort of commercial sex area. You'll have separate parts of the city set aside for commercial sex, and there's a great deal of creativity and play involved there that you don't see in the business world, for example.
Now, one character that we all know about in the West that's supposed to be the Japanese kind of essence of sex is the geisha.
Mm-hmm.
Did you learn anything about being a geisha while you were there?
I studied Japanese dance, the same kind of dance that geisha study. So there was that element of it, wearing the kimono, learning the sort of set movements. And also I spent some time in the company of some Japanese people in Gion, which is where the geisha, there are other pleasure quarter geisha, but that's one of the main ones. So I did get to observe the dancing, not the parties, which are very expensive. I wasn't part of that. But actually, the geisha do not offer sex. They offer more titillating eroticism, flirtation, the pleasure of watching them perform like a personal dance performance, that as if you're hiring some famous dancer to dance just for you in your living room. So it's that kind of thrill and that kind of titillation. And the only people who actually have sex with geisha are very rich men who've courted them for years. So they're a symbol of Japanese sexuality for us, but actually I would say maybe the Soapland girl would be a more accurate choice for...
the Soapland girl.
The prostitute.
Let's talk about the Soapland girl.
Yes. Japan, of course, has a long tradition of a licensed pleasure quarter, that is the government-supported sexuality as a way for people to let off steam so they wouldn't be staging political rebellions. So they actually had a highly developed, very creative pleasure quarters in most of the major cities.
Like a red light district.
Red light district with that offered all sorts of interesting varieties of sexual services. And the modern descendant of Yoshiwara and Shimabara and those places from pre-modern Japan is the Soapland girl, and the particular thing she offers is she will bathe you first and bathe you in very interesting ways, and then you move on to have intercourse.
In the soap.
Sometimes in the soap, they'll please you, men. I suppose a woman could. I don't know. It's hard for foreigners to penetrate that world. Actually, you need introductions. You need to speak Japanese usually, but it has been done. If you're interested, you can manage.
Well, certainly
to hold
your
off.
Protagonist seems to get into that world, into all the worlds.
Yes, yes. Well, she's motivated and has the proper introductions. That's what you need in Japan, the proper introductions.
And if you couldn't get them yourself, you got them for your character.
That's right.
Okay. So how about if we hear a little excerpt from the book?
Okay.
Can you read? Do you have enough light?
Maybe a little bit more light would help.
Okay.
Oh, thank you.
Let's have a little light here.
I want to set the scene a little bit. This scene takes place in a beautiful hot spring inn in the mountains of Gunma Prefecture, north of Tokyo. And it's an actual hot spring inn that I visited a number of times, one of my favorite places. It has a large bath with a soaring cathedral ceiling, Japanese lanterns glowing softly in the corners. And the main reason I like it is because it still allows mixed bathing between men and women, which is sadly... fading custom in Japan. Most of the time it's men on one side, women on the other. But this is an old inn, and the Japanese are willing to allow old customs to continue if it's really historical. So this takes place there. My protagonist is a bit dissatisfied with her husband, and she meets an anthropology professor in this beautiful bath, and he teaches her about a new erogenous zone. So I'm going to read just a little bit of this discovery for Lydia. The professor began tapping my asshole lightly, as if he were playing a little drum. A searing spasm of pleasure shot through my body, and I yelped in surprise. "Shall I stop?" he asked with concern. "Oh, no," I stuttered. "Please, I find pleasure in it?" the professor finished for me. "Yes." Could he see how very much I did? He made a low grunt of assent and continued to stroke my cleft, paying special attention to the ring of muscle around the hole. The sensations were so exquisite, so engulfing, my whole body trembled. "Is it the custom for your husband to touch you back here?" the professor inquired, his voice husky. "No, he never does." I sensed this was the answer he wanted, although in this case, it was also the truth. "Such a pity to ignore what we can surely call the seat of human pleasure," he murmured. "A pun?" I almost laughed, but was distracted by a new sensation, his hands pulling my ass cheeks wide. I braced for his touch, but felt only warmth, as if a feeble sun were shining on that hidden place for the very first time. I could tell he was staring at me, studying me. Dozens of men had seen my vulva, but this was the first time my ass, in truth, my most secret part, had gotten such professional attention. I squirmed uneasily. The professor guessed my thoughts. "Do not be ashamed. You are very beautiful, so clean and pink and beautiful." I felt my asshole plump up, reveling in the compliments. His finger grazed the opening. I whimpered and wiggled like a little dog happily greeting her master. Could it be I had a second clit hiding back there undiscovered all these years? "May I kiss you here?" How could I pass that up? "Yes, please." I gasped at the contact, the pillow's soft warmth pressing against that exquisitely sensitive area. The first kiss was chaste, a smack of lips against my tiny mouth. Then came the tongue rolling over my ass crack like molten silk. My knees buckled. I clenched at the smooth, damp floor, nearly sobbing with desire. He circled closer to the sweet spot, his tongue flicking and gliding. "Now push open," he commanded softly. I moaned again in shame and desire. Had I ever done anything more perverse or more exciting?
Wow.
Wow, indeed.
Some hot stuff. Whoa, a shame and desire. That's an interesting combination for Japanese sexuality.
Yes, yes, and American as well, I think.
Well, that's true.
But, yes, actually, Lydia mentions that a few times, this I'm doing something naughty, but it feels really good. She's working through that in her own sexual discovery as well, so...
And she's pretty naughty. I mean, she's cheating on her husband right there.
She is.
She had some, I guess she was with her husband and she left to take this bath.
Yes, well, he's an overworked businessman and he sort of fell asleep on her, a salary man, exactly. And he fell asleep on her and she was a little bit angry about that and met a kind of a soulmate, a person who was as into fantasy and otherworldly things as she is. So they don't actually have intercourse, but they do other exciting things.
Yes, and he's a professor of anthropology.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And a connoisseur of women.
Yes, yes.
And assholes.
Likes to study them. Yes, well, he likes to introduce people to new erogenous zones, and since that was the case for her, so...
Yes, and that became not just a one incident, but I guess that she... kind of got into that.
Yes,
into
she
that
did.
Little
more
asshole.
Of an awakening.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
the
yes.
Awakening of the anus.
Yes, yes.
Wow. The anus is, of course, a pleasure zone for everybody.
Yes.
And
equal opportunity pleasure zone.
Yeah, yeah. And do you think that that in Japan they explore that a little more, or do you think it's just universal?
Well, I can't speak for all Japanese, but there does tend to be, again, in private, just a more open-minded attitude towards pleasure and the various things you can do. And then back to the soap land, which is, that's prostitution and specialized, but part of the menu that they offer is analingus. They have special bathing stools where the soap lady can reach, that part of her client's anatomy, and that's just part of what's offered. And it's not like, whoa, this is so weird. It's just part of the service. So I think there is it's more naturalized in a way. But
a little P-spot massage.
Exactly.
For the guys.
Yes, again, I can't speak for everybody. I'm sure there are people in Japan who aren't into that and have never done it.
Well, yeah, but it's part of the Soapland menu.
Yes, it is.
Uh-huh.
It is. Mm-hmm.
And certainly part of the menu of delicacies that your character enjoys in this book.
Mm-hmm.
The Amorous, or it's called Amorous Woman.
Yes.
And Amorous Woman is taken from another ancient novel?
Yes, the 17th century novel, The Life of an Amorous Woman by Ihara Saikaku, who was a best-selling kind of, well, he did poetry as well, but he's best known for his sort of erotic books. He did one on gay pleasure and one, The Life of an Amorous Man, and then The Life of an Amorous Woman is considered his masterpiece. It's really the most psychologically complex of his erotic stories, so that appealed to me as well.
And there's a scene in which your protagonist, Lydia, is talking about what she is. I forget what she calls herself, a slut or something like that. And then her husband says, I prefer to think of you as Amorous Woman.
Ah, yes. So that was her...
not her husband. That was one of her other
lover,
men.
Yeah, yeah, her rich, her wealthy lover. And he gives her that name... Koshoku means amorous. It also means someone who loves colors and loves sensual pleasures.
Mm,
so it's definitely prettier, a prettier, more evocative word, of course, than slut. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so now how about you? I mean, is this... Have you written much erotica besides this? I haven't explored your other erotica, if you have.
I've been writing erotica for about 10 years, solely short stories, I guess,
mm-hmm.
because this is my first novel. I've always been interested in writing, but like most people, never got around to it. But in my mid-30s, I was a new mother and had some nap time to fill, and I mm-hmm. sat down and started to write, and... You know, the erotic stories are what came out. It was clearly we were meant for each other. So published my first story my first erotic story in 1999, and I've been in a number of anthologies And more to come. So.
And we met you through one of our favorite erotic writers who comes to the speakeasy a lot, Stan Kent.
Yes, we've been in a number of anthologies together with the editor, Rachel Kramer-Bussell, who's chosen our stories to be together. It's always an honor to be with Stan because he is such a good writer. And I've been in Best American Erotica and Best Mammoth, Mammoth Book of Best New Erotica, so you might see me there.
And this book, Amorous Woman, has just come out?
It's just come out in the U.S. at the beginning of June. It was originally published in the U.K. last fall. So Orion is distributing it here. It just reached these shores a few months ago.
So have any of your old Japanese lovers resurfaced and said, that's my story?
Not yet. You know, I did a book trailer where I used some of their pictures, but they haven't come after me yet. My high school friend who appears in here read the book and laughed about his portrayal.
Your high school friend? Who's
he? Yeah, he's the at the time, closeted gay man who then comes out, and he's the ballet dancer. So. The young man Lydia's involved with at first, who's a sort of a spiritual soulmate, but they don't have much of a sex life, and that's why. So the model for that read the book and was amused. He was very cool about it. So.
And how about, are you still married? Are you married?
Yes.
And how does your husband feel about your
You know, he has always been supportive. The part that was more difficult was my transition to being a writer and somebody who's all upset about editors and deadlines and the sort of politics of writing. He had some trouble getting used to that. The erotica part, he's always been extremely supportive. And this goes in two directions. One, if I need him to help me out with something in bed or some other part of our house. He's very eager to help me out with that. The blocking,
he's helped you out in bed with some of the things?
Yes, he has.
And so like what? Like the anal slapping?
Did you call it research?
We do call it research. We do. Sometimes it's that. Sometimes it's like, maybe a little embarrassing to admit, but really my sex life took off when I started writing erotica. I mean, we had a very good sex life, so I wasn't disappointing. But in terms of experimenting and really pushing things, it went hand in hand with my beginning to write erotica, which is why I recommend it to everybody. So he will help me out with things, or he'll come up with things that I will later incorporate into my stories. Or he's also my best editor, my first editor. He'll read a story and enjoy it, and that helps us feel closer because he enjoys my work.
Writing erotica is an aphrodisiac.
It totally is. I recommend it to everybody.
It really is.
Yeah? Okay.
Do you ever get so excited while you're writing something that you have to stop and masturbate?
I will say that there's always one phase of my writing where it genuinely physically turns me on. And if I don't have that in story, I consider it a failure and I don't really proceed with it. So, yeah, I would say that. But then there are other times when I'm looking at it very clinically as a writer, is this word right? And it could be the steamiest, hottest scene that really turned me on before, and I'm just looking at the words and how it's put together. So there are sort of two different phases for me in my writing. So
there's the turn-on phase, and then there's the more sort of critical phase.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. One erotic story in my life. I'm like, as a writer, I want to take a shot at this. I wrote a short story, and it took me forever. It took me forever because I had to stop and pleasure myself and think up new imaginative material for what direction I wanted to take it. And it just, you know, I had to write it alone, and it took a very long time. So I can only, you know, imagine what that must be like.
So you're not inspired to do another one?
I really am, actually.
Should,
I've been thinking about it.
Yes.
But the question is, can you read the old one and still get turned on by it?
Every time.
Oh, well, that's effective.
I should show it to you, Susie.
Yeah.
I really
Let's
should.
See if I get
I'm
going to
show it to you.
I want to see more erotica from everybody.
Yeah, yes, I will send it on over.
It has changed my life for the better. I really recommend it. And also not to be... here's one thing that I try to do when I'm writing erotica is to put myself in a special space, a special room, kind of like this. I think I'll imagine this space right here.
This being the speakeasy.
Yes, the speakeasy is really is wonderful.
Thank you.
And just nobody's watching you. Your parents, if you believe in a God who disapproves of sexuality, certainly he's gone off, or she's gone off for lunch. he's gone off for lunch. And you are in a very safe place where anything is possible, and, you know, just let whatever comes up for you happen. I mean, it sounds like you're on the right track. Just do some more.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of a space did you work on this erotic novel?
I was really surprised how I was able to take myself back to Japan at the time. It's written in the 80s and 90s when I was living there, and I was really surprised at how strong my memory was, because there's been years between when I lived there and when I wrote it, so, you know, oh, am I going to be able to recapture this? But as I was focusing more and more, the smells, the tastes, the feelings, and the visions and the people and the things they said to me came back very clearly. So it was like being in my own little Japan when I was writing it. It was very engaging, like I wasn't really quite in my own life. I had to snap back into the real world when I was finished with a writing session. So,
Has your husband ever been to Japan?
Yes, we met in Japanese class, so we share that interest. Yes.
Oh, okay. But he's also American?
Yes, he is. He is.
Now, have Japanese people been reading this erotic novel?
A few copies have been bought in Amazon Japan. It's only in English. I would love for it to be translated into Japanese, because I think the Japanese would appreciate the inspiration, the Saikaku inspiration, and they would also appreciate something I tried to do that is not that common, which is present Japanese men as, you know, charismatic
sex symbols.
Right, which,
it's usually the Japanese women that are presented that way.
Yes, it's the women, and the men
are
either
salary men,
they're boring, or they're kind of brutes, and they, you know, sort of stand as a counterpoint to the liberated American man who's so much, you know, above what, you know, men used to be, and the Japanese man.
More of a natural man,
yes,
I guess.
Yes.
The Japanese man is more controlled.
Exactly.
But it's very erotic in your book.
Yes, well, I met some extremely charismatic Japanese men when I was there, and part of it might be when they come here as tourists, they're a little bit nervous, and, you know, they're not in their home
turf. Not in their element.
But they're, you know, gracious hosts, older, younger, just very anxious to please. Now, I'm not sure if this is because I was a foreigner. That could be part of the dynamic, but really very kind and courteous and anxious to please in bed and out. So I try to convey that generosity in my novel as well. And I don't think that's all that common in American novels with Japanese male characters. There are some, but they tend to be, you know, evil, conniving people trying to take over our business or whatever, right? Something like that. So,
right. Right. Well, they're definitely, you've got lots of different Japanese men who are all very sexy in here.
Well, I'm glad that came across.
Yeah, totally. So, what was that word you used? Something kaku?
Saikaku, the author of the 17th century.
Okay. I thought that was some sort of Japanese sex word.
We could do a few of those.
Yeah,
let's
hear a few of those.
Well, this isn't the sex word exactly, but I want to mention it because a reader recently told me she thought this was really interesting. The word menkui means a face eater, which is a person, man or woman, who especially enjoys beautiful faces, so they eat faces with their eyes. So menkui, Lydia confesses that she's menkui. She likes beautiful young Japanese men as well as beautiful older Japanese men and so forth. So that's kind of an interesting term.
Face eater.
Yes.
I thought that had something to do with, like, kissing in a really kind of almost cannibalistic way.
You know, that's what it sounds like, doesn't it? That's kind of interesting. But the in Japanese, it is looking. It's not a tactile thing. It's a you're walking along the street and you see a beautiful face and your head turns sort of person. Mm. So, and let's see.
Another Japanese sex term.
Yes. Well, for fellatio, playing the bamboo flute, the shakuhachi.
Shakuhachi.
Yes.
Playing the bamboo flute.
Yes, which I like because, you know, you play the flute and it makes beautiful sounds. And when you perform fellatio on a man, he makes beautiful sounds. So I like that one.
If he's enjoying it, he does.
If he's enjoying it, yeah, yeah. Well, there are all kinds of that's the ideal situation.
And are Japanese generally quieter because they have those paper walls?
Yes. however, fortunately, do you know about love hotels?
Oh yes.
Yeah, those have soundproof walls. That's part of the services that they offer. So there, you can be louder.
I'm not as familiar with love hotels. I'm not sure if our listeners are either. Could you expand on that concept just briefly?
Sure. It's a huge business in Japan because of the paper thin walls and the fact that families still live together. You'll have mom living with you and a very small apartment with your kids or whatever. It is hard to let go. And so actually a lot of married couples use these love hotels, which are short stay hotels. So you would rent them for 2 hours. You can also stay overnight, but the 2 hour option is the most popular. The thing is, we have no-tell motels and, you know, assignation sorts of places, but these are really specializing in that, and they often have creative themes. They have well-appointed rooms with great stereo systems, TVs, like black-lit murals on the walls of New York City or an undersea world. And they just cater to a couple's pleasure. So you'll have, like, college kids who live in dorms or with their parents will go, married couples who are looking for privacy, of course, people having affairs, you know, mm-hmm. obviously. And sometimes, like, foreigners who are in for a treat will go to one of these places and stay there instead of a regular hotel because the prices are very reasonable. They're more reasonable than, say, your standard Western style hotel in Japan. The other thing about them is you don't have to talk to anybody. It's all automated. You go in there, computer screens, you pick your room, you touch it, it leads you there with blinking lights, it automatically opens the door for you. You pay with your credit card automatically or with cash through a chute, and nobody sees you, nobody will tell. So it's
very private.
Preserves your
very
privacy.
Discreet.
Yes. Yes. Mm. So
well, we're going to be opening up a hotel one day, mm-hmm. and one of our models is the Japanese love hotel.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That would be good.
Yeah, yeah.
That would be good.
You know, we have some Western touches, but that's certainly a model. So bondage plays a rather prominent role in your novel.
Yes, especially the art of Japanese bondage, shibari, which, as many things in Japan do, focuses on the aesthetic beauty of the knots and the way
shibari,
the body is tied.
S-H-I-B-A-R-I.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And this is all about tying these knots in very beautiful ways.
Yes.
And very secure ways.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And there's quite a few characters that seem to get involved in bondage in your book.
Yes. Especially the man who Lydia thinks may be her real sexual equal in terms of appetite and curiosity. Masaru. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, this is actually a fantasy scene, not a real scene, but...
But in the beginning, she walks in on him in the
yes.
middle of her wedding.
Yes.
And he's having sex with her best friend.
Yes, and he has
and
her
And he's got her all tied up.
Tied up, yes. Mm-hmm.
In a kind of a strange position.
Yes, mm. yes.
Describe the position.
Well, this is called the crab position, where your knees are sort of pushed up and they're tied to your wrists. So you're very open and just fully open and exposed to your lover. So it's this completely revealing, vulnerable position. And Lydia thinks she'd like to try that someday, too.
She doesn't wind up in that position, only in fantasy.
Only in fantasy, yes.
But she does get tied up somewhere else, doesn't she?
She has an affair with an American, and they like to tie each other up in the love hotels. Many of the love hotels have bondage rooms.
Right.
They like to do that to each other. Their relationship has kind of an edge to it in that way. They like to use power play. So.
Mm-hmm. And why did you use an American to get into that power play?
Well, that is kind of an extension of my experience of living in Japan, where when you're dealing with Japanese people, not that they don't have a sense of humor, but certainly in your work life, there's not that much humor. There's no way to express passion, say you're an English teacher or something like that. So we like to joke a lot and be kind of iconoclastic and put down authority, and that doesn't happen too often in Japan in public. In private it does. So Americans tend to have this built-up desire to be bad and joke around, and I think Lydia's lover, Matt, definitely has some suppressed passion, shall we say, and when they get together, they can let it out, and it's really electric.
They have a love-hate thing.
They have a love-hate relationship. They like to taunt each other and make sort of, I think they like each other underneath it all, but they like to tease each other in a way that borders on kind of the nasty sometimes. But then that fires up their passion to run off to a love hotel and tie each other up, spank each other and so forth.
Mm-hmm. So do you explore these bondage positions and games?
In my personal life? Somewhat, not quite to that extent. Never tried shibari. I've read about it and seen beautiful photographs and so forth. But spanking, yes, that's a
spanking.
Mm-hmm,
yes,
mm-hmm.
And that's something you and your husband.
Yes, we're kind of vanilla, so in a mild vanilla kind of way. I know we would probably strike many people as vanilla, but it works for us. So
spanking is almost in vanilla area.
Yeah,
I mean, I guess it depends on how you look at it.
Right.
I mean, for some people who have a fetish for spanking and just don't know how to introduce it to their partner, it's way beyond. It's very kinky.
Yes.
Do you have any suggestions for how to introduce it?
I would say start gently with a nice gentle, you know, you're in the middle of having very vanilla intercourse. Well, let's speak with a man introducing it to the woman, I guess, is the woman's on top, you sort of spank her gently on the buttocks, and it's going to feel good, and she might be willing to go a little farther with that, I would say. I mean, you know, some people might feel that just any spanking alone is too kinky, but when you realize that it actually is something that feels good, it doesn't hurt, or it doesn't have to. I know some people like more intense spanking, but it can be something that just enhances vanilla pleasure.
And if you're going to be whacking anywhere, that's the best area. It's got the most padding.
Definitely.
You know, if you're going to be getting that aggression out somehow, might as well do it on the butt.
Mm-hmm. But it's more like, for me, it's more like just making the pleasure more intense. There isn't any real sense of hostility. It's more like something we do together, you know, to heighten our pleasure. So
I wouldn't say hostility, but there is a little aggression.
Yeah, that's true.
It's a little aggressive.
That's true.
You know, whack.
Yeah,
whack.
Edgier.
Not
mm-hmm.
just caress.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah. So, okay. Well, we like spanking. We like all this stuff. little bondage. You know, we have a bondage cross here in the speakeasy. So I guess we should have a bunch of Japanese tourists come here.
Huh? Well, there was they tend to have like booms. If something's popular in Japan, the whole country loves it. And in the early 90s, there was a S&M boom, and you know, all the love hotel bondage rooms were booked up solid and so forth. So I don't know what the boom is right now.
Now, there's a boom in Japan. Well, I don't know if it's a boom, but you don't really get into this in your book too much, but this interest in panties.
Oh, yeah, the schoolgirl panties thing. Yeah. That was a boom in the 90s, and I think it's still lingering, as is S&M. I mean, because Japan has such a hierarchical society, power play is especially potent there. overturning it or, you know, taking it to extremes. I think it really does have an extra kick over there. You know, mm-hmm. I would say that. I'm not the total expert. But the panties was a big deal in the 90s, and there was this man who was supposedly selling panties worn by schoolgirls, and they were snapped up at a great rate. And a friend of
mine... They were probably worn by construction workers.
Exactly, or yeah. painted with some kind... There was reports that they were just sort of... They dropped, you know, things on them that had nothing to do with an actual woman wearing them. But then other people, you know, auction off their panties. So I think there probably are some real women who do it. And somebody sent me a photograph of a vending machine that supposedly sells used panties today, so it lingers on in a few places, but it's not as big of a deal as it once was.
Do you have another passage you'd like to read us?
Oh, well, is there anything in particular?
Maybe something. Can we have the light again? Maybe something from The Rich Lover.
The Rich Lover, yeah. I like him a lot. I do. I guess that's, you know, my father complex, you know.
But the way he drops her is so cruel and
it
so
is,
cold.
It is. But she has overstepped the line. She has done something that he cannot tolerate, and so no reason to...
Well, then there was that performance she did. That's a good passage, too,
to
read. To get back at
him.
She does
that.
That English lesson, yes. That's pretty kinky.
So there's a scene where he rents a prostitute for her. Let's see. Should we do the English lesson?
I'll leave it up to you.
Oh, boy. It's hard to...
Whatever you can find in there. You're flipping.
Yes, I am.
The English lesson is good. So, and also the... When he hires the woman.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the Naomi. Oh, boy.
And her fantasy also is great when she fantasizes about the business meeting.
Oh, yeah.
That's really good.
That is a favorite scene. That's really long, though. I don't know how long you want me to go with that.
Well, you could do that one. I don't think that's too long.
Okay. All right.
If you can find it.
Yeah, I know where it is.
It also, you know, really gives us a good feeling for the whole Japanese business model in a sexual fantasy form.
All right. So I will just start with more of the hot part. So Lydia has a very active fantasy life, and she finds out that her best Japanese girlfriend is actually a pornographer. She writes pornographic comics, and imagine that, such a nice, sweet woman doing something like that. And she brings home some of her comics and then gets some ideas from it. And the fantasy that she has is that she is the lover of the president of a company, and he invites her to a restaurant. And instead of just the two of them, there are three other handsome young men and a very compelling woman, an older woman, who asks Lydia to take off her panties in the ladies' room so that the president can collect them. And then she ends up playing a little trick on Lydia, and I'll read from that, and if I go on too long, just let me know. "I have an idea," Miss Inouye said in her commanding tenor. "I suggest the gentlemen play a guessing game. Did you know our colleague Lydia-san had something in her possession when she left the room that she no longer has now? Whoever can guess what this is will win a very special prize." The young men turned to Lydia, who blushed furiously. The crafty Miss Inouye had betrayed her, although to be fair, there had never exactly been a bond of trust between them. "Did she take off her earrings?" a shy, moon-faced fellow named Fuji offered. "She doesn't wear earrings. Don't you pay attention to anything?" his senior by a year, the hawkish but handsome Masaru Nakamoto said, poking Fuji with an elbow. "I guess she took off her stockings." "Stand up, Lydia, and show Mr. Nakamoto if he is correct," Miss Inouye said. Lydia stood, too flustered to protest. I'm afraid you're wrong, Mr. Nakamoto, the woman sneered, running a possessive hand over Lydia's calf. These pretty American legs are covered up quite properly. She left her handkerchief in the laboratory, offered the third and youngest salaryman, Hamada, a cherub fresh from college. Wrong again, snapped Miss Inoue. President Takata, would you care to take a turn? Takata smiled. Lydia felt her heart pounding in her throat. Would her lover betray her in front of her colleagues? How could she possibly face them in the office tomorrow? I have an idea of what might be missing, the boss said slyly, but modesty forbids me to put it into words. Perhaps if Lydia could lift her skirt and show us. How do you say it in English? A picture is worth a thousand words? Standing before them, her face on fire, Lydia hung her head. She knew she should march from the room immediately to keep the final tatters of her reputation intact, but a reckless, defiant part of her knew the opinion of these men meant nothing. The game was rigged, as it always was in Japan. It was Miss Inoue who mattered, and Lydia wanted nothing more than to show this goading woman she could stand anything she dished up, even take her one better. Slowly she grasped the hem of her skirt and hiked it up over her thighs. The men's eyes followed the rising movement of the skirt, inch by aching inch. A collective gasp filled the room. Lydia-san doesn't wear panties, breathed Hamada. Not exactly, Mr. Hamada, Miss Inoue said, unzipping her purse and pulling out the limp, soiled panties. She was wearing these until a moment ago. I was surprised at how quickly she agreed to take them off. Lydia scanned the faces of her colleagues, hoping for an ally among them, but she could tell by the glowing eyes focused squarely on her naked mons that Miss Inoue had won them over to her side. Now that the game is decided, I propose our American colleague reward each man according to the merit of his guess, Miss Inoue continued. Mr. Fuji comes in last with the earrings because the ear is farthest in distance from the correct location. Since a handkerchief is carried in the pocket, Hamada earns 1 point, but Nakamoto earns 2 for pantyhose, which consensus would surely hold comes closest. And of course, our wise president guessed correctly, so he wins the grand prize. Could you elaborate on the prizes you have in mind, Director Inoue? Takata asked softly. With pleasure, boss. In this contest, the third runner-up earns the privilege of fondling Lydia's bare breasts and rubbing his penis in her cleavage if he so desires. The second runner-up wins the right to caress her between the legs and have her pleasure him with her hand until he reaches satisfaction. The first runner-up may use his mouth and enjoy the skills of her lips and tongue in return. And the winner? Here she smiled at the shacho, whose face was flushed with titillation. The winner may do whatever he desires with our naughty little Lydia.
Mm.
And he does.
Yes. And what he desires is to have Miss Inoue
yes.
do the honors.
Yes, so does Lydia, actually. It's a scene of group participation, shall we say, by the
group
end.
Group sex.
Yes, yes.
Have you ever had group sex?
I have not, no. Well, no, wait a minute.
Wait a minute.
What do you define as a group?
Well, more than one other partner.
In my vanilla way, yes. Mm-hmm.
Oh, let's hear in your vanilla way what you mean.
Well, it wasn't full, you know, all the way, but it was kind of a make-out session with two men and me. So.
Two men and mm-hmm, you? Mm-hmm. In Japan or somewhere else?
Yes, in Japan.
In Japan.
Very nice.
Yeah, yeah. So.
But your imagination has taken you farther than just making out.
Yes, it has indeed.
There's some vivid group sex in there.
Mm-hmm.
And is that something that turns you and your husband on to think about, or you just sort of figured you needed to have some group sex in an erotic novel?
As I said, everything I write turns me on some level. I just can't pull it off if it doesn't. So, yes, that is one of the in the library that I like to think about. Not at the top. I think my top one is a kind of an exhibitionist thing. It's a very writerly thing, but showing my mm-hmm. true self is really probably my very favorite fantasy, and I guess I'm doing it as a
writer. You're yes. sure doing that. And we're exploring it even more, finding out which of the things are just made up and which of them...
Everybody asks me that, and they all expect me to blush and say, oh, for heaven's sake. But I always say, you know, yeah, a lot of it's autobiographical, and I figure why not be honest? That's what it's about.
So. How about the sex with women? Have you had sex with women?
No, I've been attracted to women, but not actual sex. So for that, I interview people. when I when I haven't had that experience. And they've been very generous with their sensual. I like interviewing people about those things, and I think they like talking about it. I like listening. So.
Who do you interview? Friends?
Friends, yeah.
And you just talk to friends about their sexual experiences and.
Yes, and you know, I think people, when they know it's for the sake of literature or communication, they like to help out. They get into it. So.
You know, people like to talk about sex if it's for the sake of just about anything.
That's true, but when there's a higher purpose, it makes it even more more
oh, yeah.
pleasurable.
Then they feel much better about themselves. That little shame mixed with desire gives way to the desire.
Yeah, more. Yeah, and they also like somebody being interested in them, and you know, this kind of. Secret part of themselves when somebody's genuinely interested, genuinely supportive, as you well know, it can work magic. So I enjoy the research part in that way as well. That's, I guess, another form of my research.
So are you working on another erotic work now?
My next project will come back to America, and I'm really fascinated with American sexual culture, and it will be looking at some aspects of American sexual expression in the 20th century, burlesque in the 30s. I'm really interested in Sally Rand from the Chicago World's Fair, and Betty Page.
She was a burlesque dancer,
yes,
Sally Rand.
She was a burlesque dancer and extremely popular, and something that vanilla type people would take like their girlfriends on dates to watch Sally Rand. Now, she wasn't really that. She was discreet and suggestive, but still erotic. I saw one of her performances on YouTube, and interesting that somebody would take their girlfriend there on a first date or something. But that's great. So.
Well, she was kind of like Gypsy Rose Lee, I guess, in an earlier generation.
Yeah, yeah.
And Betty Page.
Yes. Betty Page, and
so what are you writing a novel about a girl like this?
Well, it's another one of these things, like Amorous Woman, where there's an intellectual component, and it will be a professor. I have an academic background, write what you know, who is discovering that she's really more interested in writing about sexuality than like the staid topic that she originally started out in her career. And she's also pushed into this because she and her husband are having some
sexual difficulties.
Well, actually, her husband wants to swing, and she has problems with it at first. And they split up. But then once they're splitting up, she discovers that she actually does have a lot more curiosity. And so she has some personal adventures while she's researching these things about.
So she researches these great sexual women of the past,
yes.
And in so doing, she has her own adventures.
Yes, she's sort of inspired by it. So.
Yeah, that sounds like the story of a lot of erotica writers these days. I mean, you're probably that's a story that a lot of them can relate to. A lot of us can relate to.
Yeah, well, it's kind of the main narrative of erotica is a woman's self-discovery. Even if a man is writing it, that seems to be the major narrative, so I can certainly relate to it.
So how old are your kids now?
9 and 13.
And do they know what Mom does?
They know Mom writes books for adults, and when they start asking questions, I'll answer in an age-appropriate way. I think being an open, involved parent in this way will help me pass on my values rather than letting the media and kind of a sexophobic culture have everything to do with it. You can't stop it, but if we can have honest discussions about what I think is important and so forth, again, age appropriate, I think I'll be doing them a service as a parent. So.
Great. Well, I'll interview them on the show. When
yeah,
18,
that yeah, would be good.
About you.
Yeah, when they're 18.
So, what do you think? I mean, you think that? I mean, some kids get embarrassed about their parents' sexuality.
Yeah. I mean, I think my older son, the 13-year-old, like, is a little bit. He hasn't expressed interest in it really, just a little bit, blushy. But he blushes at a lot of things. So, but I think in a way he's proud of me for being a published author. I sense that from him as well. And
have you written other published works besides erotic?
Yes, I have. I've been published in some respectable literary magazines like Prairie Schooner, the Gettysburg Review, Fourth Genre. I do personal essays as well. So I can do both of those things.
And which is more lucrative?
Well, it's easier, but I'm more established as an erotica writer, and editors who I've worked with are nice when I send them something, whereas the literary magazine world, for most people, there are the stars, much more competitive. Like, even places that have accepted my work, you'd think they'd be a little nicer. No, just the form rejection. So.
And do they hold it against you that you write erotica?
I don't know. I haven't been, flaunted it, although, like, the Prairie Schooner story was set in Japan and it's pretty edgy, has some erotic elements to it, and they happily published it, and it got a special mention in Pushcart. So I guess the straight literary world is interested in sex too.
So what kind of people read your erotica? Is it mostly for women or for men?
That's interesting. Asking people to read my book or telling them about my book, I've had a lot more interest from men, not more men than women, but I tend to think of my readers as women.
Mm-hmm.
But men are like, you know, oh, that sounds interesting, I'd like to read it, which they didn't do with my academic book for some reason. But this book, this erotic novel about Japan, and men also, I hear, don't read as much fiction, but this they seem interested in. So I think this one is getting more male readers than my other works. But I'd say, you know, more women read erotica. I don't know. Do you have some figures on that? It seems, you know, women want their story.
I mean, certainly men are more compelled to seek erotic stimulation through pornography,
mm-hmm.
erotica.
Visual,
but also written. But, I mean, men tend to maybe like just a scene, I'm
mm-hmm.
generalizing terribly.
Yes,
being very sexist right now.
I know.
But, you know, in terms of a novel, it seems like more women are
uh-huh.
likely to like an erotic novel. What
yeah.
do you think, Joe? Do you like to read erotica?
Sometimes when it's in the back of a Playboy and I, you know, like, you know, you're kind of
yeah.
thinking about things. You're like, yeah, sometimes, you know.
Read a little.
I think I think you made it all very clear, though, when you started that with
exactly.
sometimes at the back of Playboy.
I mean, after all.
I think we get it.
I'm not going to try to, like, you know, pretend that it's like, you know, it's the first thing in my mind. But, I mean, literally, like, when, you know, the whole underwear. I just, you know, like, while you're talking about it, I realize I'm like, you know, I am kind of a little girl panty guy. I'm like,
ooh.
I was going to say stuff, but
really,
everybody was so
stuff.
Intense.
No,
was
no,
like,
but now,
even
me, now we want to hear.
I was just listening.
Panty guy.
I just got myself in trouble.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that might have some truth to it, though, because I love erotic fiction.
I love little girl panties.
Hey, a lot of people love little girl panties.
True enough.
Well, on that note, I have to say, I have to type in my speakeasy password.
Uh-oh.
Somehow I got off of here. Does
yeah,
that
we're on the hour.
We're on the hour?
Well, it's 90 minutes, so we have until 12:30.
Yeah, we have a little more time, but
so
somehow
let me come check out.
Locking you down.
What is the password? Oh, I know what the password is. Wait a second. I think I do.
Yeah.
I'm going to type it in. Oh, I'm back.
And it's interesting, too, because, like, I didn't know what the subject was going to be tonight, but my first girlfriend in California was Japanese, and it gave me some a little strange insight, you know, not a lot, but enough. I mean, obviously, I can only pick up so much in 45 minutes to an hour, but nonetheless, like I said, I was like, whoa. Yeah, I was trying to, like, I was like, oh, man, I wonder, you know, like, because there's obvious huge cultural differences between here and Japan. I know I messed up in a lot of ways that, you know, like...
But aren't you from Hawaii?
Oh, me?
No,
me?
Not from Hawaii.
Me?
No, never mind.
Or, no.
I'm sorry. You're not from Hawaii.
No, not at all.
No, but wait, okay.
I'm half Sicilian.
Half Sicilian.
And Vietnamese.
Half
if you really
Vietnamese.
Need to
know. Okay.
I know it's a strange...
I know there was some country
breed.
That was closer to Japan than California.
Well, it's Asian, but yeah,
it's
not
Asian,
very close
but not
to
that.
Japan
actually, maybe it is
reality.
Even closer to Japan than California. Well, Vietnamese, I guess, is a little different. But you had a Japanese girlfriend.
Yes, yes. That was my very first girlfriend in California was Japanese.
And why was she different?
Well, you could just, obviously the language barrier was very rough for us at first.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, that was probably the biggest problem that actually occurred. But I don't know. I don't think still to this day, it's almost an enigma to me. I was like, I thought I was doing things like the way I normally would do them, and I definitely was coming across as the wrong kind of person from the Japanese point of view. And I, you know, like, obviously I've been American all my life, so I don't have a very good point of view, but there was certain, like, just the way you were talking about, like, the, like, almost like the female domination point of view and a few other, like, the openness of, like, this, you know, the group sex, and there was a lot of things that I was like, well, obviously they think of things a lot different in Japan than they do here, so, like, it just gave me a point of view that I was like, obviously, you know, it's a totally different way to look at how things were going. And it just kind of reminded me of, like,
Richard's calling about mature Japanese women.
Okay.
Let's put him on the line. Hello, Richard.
Are you there, Richard?
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Richard.
Hi.
Hi. Welcome to Radio Susie One.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. So did you have a question or a comment about Japanese women?
Yeah. I'm trying to go out with one. I'm in my mid-30s. I love older women, but I've always wanted to be with older Japanese women.
Could you talk about
older
Richard?
Japanese woman.
Could you talk a little louder, Richard?
You're in your 30s, right? And talk a little louder, Richard. You're talking in a very
soft whisper,
right? So do you have an older Japanese woman in mind, or are you just sort of thinking in general?
In general.
And is there a reason that you're interested in Japanese women?
Yes, I find the exoticness to be erotic, and I've always been sexually aroused by them.
Okay, well, that's legitimate. And older ones?
Yes.
Like, so you're in your 30s, so someone in her 40s?
Yeah.
Okay. So now, what would you suggest, Sensei, for the men who like the Japanese women, especially older Japanese women, which we all, of course, find refreshing here?
Yes.
Something to look forward to for Terry when she's older, and who want older women.
Well, I mean, in terms of how to court or something to keep in mind, verbal expression, and this also gets back to the other issue, saying things is not as important as sort of showing them and feeling them.
Mm.
So gestures, rather than saying I'm attracted to you or whatever, it would be doing something very nice and not sort of overwhelming her with the words.
Like what kind of thing?
More gently suggesting. So suggestion is appreciated more by the Japanese than that when you say things that it feels a bit too aggressive. So
if Richard wants to have sex with a Japanese woman, what should he do instead of saying, I would like to have sex with you?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Right.
Yeah.
Because obviously he'd like to say that and just get it going on. But that would probably get him booted out of, you know, the geisha house.
Yeah. The commercial possibilities are, you know, always there, so that's easier. But in
buying
terms of
buying gifts
would work.
That works. Buying.
But creating
gifts.
A romantic evening where you show a sense of interest and caring, I think. This sounds like for American women as well, but I guess just American women like, I love you, you're beautiful, and that sort of thing. And not that Japanese don't, it's just that you don't want to do that too early. You want to show.
It always means more, and especially intimately when your gestures as far as your gentleness and romanticizing make for a better evening, especially if it's an intimate evening.
Flowers.
Well,
get her flowers.
Exactly, or
right.
Find
Don't
out
spend too much
somehow,
to begin with.
But. If you could find out something she likes and enjoys without her actually having told you, so by your own sort of powers of observation, and you surprise her a little bit with, I know you because I've been paying attention and I care about you, rather than, you know, so what do you like? You know, do you
get her this novel, Amorous Woman. This will either turn her on or...
Yeah, bro, I wish I would have had this. I was totally fumbling the ball.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It's called Ishin Denshin. It's communication without words. And if you can show that you can do that and you can care about her without being so American and verbal, I think she'll be really blown away by that. So that would be my suggestion.
Maybe it was me talking.
Okay.
Yeah. Americans tend to like to talk a lot about their feelings.
I probably screwed that up big time.
Yeah.
Well,
I think
many...
In general, if,
what was that,
okay,
Richard?
Let's say if I wanted just a night of just letting it all hang out, passionate, no...
Go to Soapland. Soapland is for
you. Just going to, you know, pretty much just get some of the Japanese women, you know, I mean, romanticizing, not like that. I mean, even if it came down just one night stand, because it's fantasy of mine, how does that complace with, you know, the gentleness and the instead of words that are dimes a dozen, I mean, how does that venture into this, you know?
He likes the wordless part.
Yeah.
He does, but he really wants a one-night stand. So have you ever, I mean, I don't know if they have soap lands in the United States, but they do have massage parlors, which are quasi-legal, of course. But have you ever been to one of those?
No, I haven't. I mean...
Well, I mean, you know, it is a one-night stand, or afternoon, or morning, as the case may be.
No, not so much. I mean, I have more like, you know, just an intimate relationship, or it's
a relationship.
Not so much. I mean, you know, there's going to be romanticizing and just gentleness there, but, you know, just, you know, more like an ongoing thing, where it's more like two adults consenting to have an intimate relationship without all the drama.
Yeah, drama. Well, you know, a lot of the drama is part of the romance, and that's what turns women on to some extent, any women of any culture. But let me ask you a question, Richard. How do you meet Japanese women? I mean, is there a way that you are planning to meet them? Are you going to go to Japanese language classes, or are you going to, like, look for them in the Internet, or what?
I wouldn't know. That's pretty much where I'm at right now. I to me, going on the internet is kind of cool and stuff, but, I mean, to get to that level, I mean, most of the time, if you're on the computer and you're doing those levels, it's like, you know, there's that barrier where it's just like, okay, you can present yourself, but, you know, the people don't really know you, and there's a lot of sickos out there, you know, they're just,
you.
Places that specialize
in Japanese women who are interested in American men, I think.
Oh, you mean like dating services?
Yeah, online.
Oh, have you ever tried anything like that where they actually specialize?
No, I wouldn't know where to look. I mean, I'm at the point where.
But they're not generally looking for a one night stand. That's what Richard wants.
Not generally, yeah.
Richard, here's what you got to do. Go to Japan.
Yeah.
Go to Japan, and then you'll be an exotic foreigner.
So there are websites where American men or foreign men share, like, places they've been to that they think are good. I mean, just Google that, and they'll tell you the neighborhoods and possibly exact addresses of places where they welcome foreigners. And it's not easy to do if you just go without any kind of research, because if you don't speak Japanese, it's hard to get into these places. But I've seen information online.
So, Richard.
Yes.
You've got to go to Japan, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Because most of the Japanese women that come to America, maybe I don't know if they're in these dating services, they want to get married.
We don't want to get into the term of Americanized, but that solely plays into that factor, you know. It becomes a reality.
All right, Richard. Well, is there anything else we can help you with tonight?
No. I mean, as far as that goes, I was so at dire straits where it was the point where I just wanted to throw my number out there, but I know you can't do that, so.
Throw your number? Your phone number?
If you really wanted to. Who cares?
Yeah.
I really don't care if you want all the, you know, a bunch of crank people will call you, probably.
You might get some psychos.
Sure,
bro.
That'll be hilarious.
You get a bunch
I can get back with you and tell you what kind of people are out
there. That'll be all right for Richard. So go ahead, Richard.
Okay.
Don't give out my number now. No.
It's 323-590-2845.
Wow, Richard's home number. All you Japanese older women, rush to your phones. See who can be the first to call. And I mean, what do you have to offer these women, Richard?
Just passion.
Just passion.
And to, you know.
You're not good looking, and you don't have any money. Just passion. That's all.
Yeah, money's not the issue. I mean, money.
For Japanese women,
it
might be.
What was that? I'm sorry.
No. Well, Richard, what kind of work do you do?
Me, I'm a union plumber right now, but I'm learning IT computer systems. Where I'm going to be pretty much a self-employed person. I've got aspects of IBM and pretty much now it was WAMU, but now it's Chase. So.
Right. WAMU gave way to Chase. WAMU, the biggest failure of an American bank, I think, right?
Yeah.
It's huge. Gigantic.
Engineered failure of the American system.
It was eerie because I just opened another bank account. I'm not going to say which bank, but I opened it on Thursday because I was afraid. And then WAMU went under.
Yeah.
Went down big time.
I knew
Thursday
it.
Thursday night.
I bank with them too. I'm so frustrated.
And
the main thing is
cool.
They said all assets are still there. Nobody's losing any money. And I'm glad the government got involved, because if not, there would have been a lot of losses.
Now, wait a second.
A couple of months ago.
Actually, we're all insured for if we have under 100,000 in there.
Yeah.
The government is bailing out more than 100 grand,
you have to put it in separate banks.
But
just
the
so
government is bailing out
you know.
The really rich people, I think. Right? Isn't that right?
The ultra-rich only.
I mean, the rest of us would have been insured, but the ultra-rich, you know, had a problem. And so, you know, King George II decided to cough up some more money just before he left. I mean, this is the final fleecing of the government by the Bush crime family. The final, well, maybe not final, but the final fleecing of the Bush administration, I guess.
Absolutely.
It's been fleecing all the way through. Anyway, how did we get onto this? Oh, WAMU. Oh, you were talking about working for WAMU, and we were talking about the major crash that we're all going through. Well, we're all going to have to be looking for yen and euros. And pesos,
because the
dollar will be worth nothing.
There is talk that they want to create, I guess, Canada.
Watch out for the Amero.
They're talking about making it Ameros.
Yes.
Ameros. What's that?
Yeah.
I haven't heard of that.
That
yeah,
is the
yeah,
scam.
They want to combine. I guess they want to, you know, be part of the European mix.
They
want to
combine Canada, America, and Mexico.
Called Ameros.
And
Canada,
South
America, and Mexico.
And South America, if they can get it on. But I don't think Venezuela is going to fly like that. Russia's already put two Tu-160 supersonic bombers in Venezuela to prevent that possibility. But we're going to see what the dealio is very soon here.
They want to make a single currency.
Yes. Just like the European Union. Obviously, you're aware of the
and
euro.
And they're doing really well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's beating the American dollar because it's basically backed by the same British bastards.
It's expensive over there now.
Yeah. Well, it's expensive for us because the American dollar at one point used to go very far. But at this point, let's say that I was in Amsterdam in 99.
Yeah.
My American dollar went really far. I mean, I was rocking. But now, you know, you go over this, you know, the same American dollar will get you you'll get about 30% less than what you used to get, what you're used to getting in California, which is not exactly the most, dollar-friendly place there ever was.
Now, how are we doing with the yen? I mean,
I don't know the relative. I'm sure, relatively speaking, I'm sure we're not doing good, but...
Relatively to where we were before the Bush administration. Yeah.
They have run us into the ground.
Deeply. We're groundhogs.
And it was on purpose.
Pretty much.
I don't think it was anything personal. They just wanted all the money.
It was. Yeah.
It was
just business.
It wasn't like they wanted to hurt the American people. They just wanted...
It's just they were in the way between the money
exactly.
The American people had and them.
Yeah, exactly. Nothing personal or anything.
It's just, you got money that we want.
Wow. It's crazy times.
It's
that we
the
live
strangest
in.
Time of all times to be alive.
Well, that's hard to say.
Oh,
if
you
it's
will
the
see
strangest
it soon.
Time of all time. Will I see it soon? So it hasn't happened yet. The strangest.
No,
thing.
We are seeing the very. If you take the roller coaster analogy, we are just getting up to the very top of where the decline begins.
And I
use that term very specifically.
Huh. I wonder how that'll affect our sexuality.
Yeah.
That is interesting.
Maybe
yeah.
that's all we'll have left.
Well,
in
we always
end.
Do have that.
In the end.
We do, so far, we
it'll
do have
clubs,
that.
It'll be clubs, stones, and boning, I guess.
I think if half these politicians worried about what you know, their sexuality was and their interest in the bedroom as opposed to money, then they might be okay.
if they put more of their interest in the bedroom than into
yes.
to money,
yes.
if they were more into lust than into greed.
If we were all more right. into love than into greed, who knows how the world would be.
Well, love,
not
love
necessarily
is
lust.
It's related to lust.
I
think love is
lust,
very
myself.
Much related to lust.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. They
know.
Are the same coin in a strange
well,
way.
Love is a little more emotional.
It's the other side of the coin.
Yeah, I mean, it's related to lust. But greed is a whole other thing. Greed is very competitive.
I think lust comes into a factor when you more or less love a person as opposed to you are in love with them.
Before we end, let's talk about the Japanese idea
about,
of love versus
brother,
the American
you love
idea.
Your friend and she's female. I'm talking about if you're in a relationship. And
what are you talking about?
Hmm?
No, we don't want to know what you're talking about, Richard.
we're
going to talk about the Japanese idea of love and lust versus the American idea with our expert, Donna.
You
want to
stay on, Richard?
Story. Richard can stay on.
Okay.
This is very complex. I'm not quite sure where to begin. There, as I was saying, there is that idea that saying I love you is not as important as showing that. And by being a good provider for your wife and children, that's the way of saying I love you. And I told Japanese men don't say I love you as much as American men. It's just not something they do. And vice versa with the women. So it's interesting. There's a movie, Shall We Dance? With Richard Gere and Susan Sarandon. It's an American remake of a Japanese movie, Shall We Dance? And if you compare them side by side, that's a great example of the difference in the way that you show love and express your emotions as a couple between the husband and wife in the Japanese version and in the American version. So, you know, Richard Gere gives Susan Sarandon a rose at the end, and my Japanese friend said, you know, that was just not going to happen in Japan. So.
No giving roses.
Really?
I thought that was a gesture.
That there you go. That it might happen, but there's
more like Swarovski.
Well, you know what they've done to Valentine's Day in Japan? They've made it into a holiday where women give men chocolate. Because they know the men aren't going to do it.
Can I ask
women
a question?
Say no.
Oh, I really have an important question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My Japanese girlfriend took care of me. I mean, took care of me. Oh. She took me out. She bought me things. She was incredible. And then just one day it was over. And I'm like, what in the hell just happened?
Hey, that sounds like my novel.
Oh, crap.
Is that the way it goes?
Well, there is a very strong maternal element in Japanese women. They do like to take care of you.
I had never heard of it before.
Mm-hmm. And just do take good care of you and make your life really nice.
So
but
that's kind of
until they're done. And then they're done.
And then, you know, just one day it was over.
And
okay.
She never said why or anything. See,
well, I think I was the stopover for her Japanese boyfriend and the language barrier, yada, yada. Supposedly my dick was too big.
Ooh,
I can have worse complaints.
Exactly. It could be worse.
I could have worse complaints, but whatever. That's just what happened. I ain't going to lie.
Huh. Well, we're not going to go there in terms of the myths about. I mean, the myth mm-hmm. about. I guess we are going to go there. The myth is that Japanese men are built small.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's a variety in every race. I've found most of them were just fine.
Just fine. But we don't know what you think is just fine.
That's true. That's true. You don't. But not real small. But I'm told by some people that, you know, more American men are, like, too big for them, like Asian friends. So there could be something to the fit, you know.
Hear that, Richard?
Yes, I did.
You could be too big. Richard isn't bothered by that.
But really, I have to say, it was, size was not at all a problem for me. And, you know, I don't think I'm too incredibly small or anything like that.
Well, there isn't that much of a difference anyway, you know, it, among anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, porn stars.
Right.
Now, how about this whole bukkake craze? You don't have that in the book.
Yeah, I don't. Isn't that interesting? I believe that started because of Japanese censorship laws. They weren't allowed to show genitals and actual, you know, penetration and so forth, so they had to get creative. And one thing they could do is show
bukkake.
men ejaculating on women.
Yeah. On uh-huh. women, on uh-huh. all over their faces.
Right.
So it looks like the woman had a big sneeze or something.
Right.
I mean, it's amazing. And what I've heard is that it comes from a tradition, and I don't know if this is really true or this is just a modern urban myth, a tradition in which if a woman was slutty or a woman, you know, had an affair or something, that she would be taken into the center, like instead of being stoned, she'd be raped.
Hmm.
And so somehow bukkake came to be, you know, kind of squirting all over slutty women.
Mm-hmm. Symbolic rape kind of thing.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't know that much about it, just that it was one of the variations that enabled them to be sort of explicit and sexy, but still, you know, be legal. So.
Okay, so it was practical.
Yeah.
See, I thought it came from this old, like, medieval Japanese tradition.
It may be. I don't know. That would make it more interesting still.
Yeah. All right, well, we're just about out of time here, I think, are we? I'm not sure what time it is, actually. Is that time right?
That's probably right now.
Okay. Well,
we
okay, then.
About 4 minutes.
About four minutes.
We have about 4 minutes, so we should get our paparazzi over here. Hey, Mar, are you there? Yeah, we should take a little picture of us at the radio. We're going to close the show and let us know where we can get the book, obviously on Amazon.
Yes, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Powell's, and Borders. It's available throughout the world, Amazon UK, Amazon Germany, Amazon Japan, and the U.S., of course.
And what's it called?
Amorous Woman by Neon Orion. And I'm the author, Donna George Story. And if you're interested in Japan, it will be a book that takes you on a journey to that country.
And even if you're not that interested in Japan, it's a very sexy, hot book.
Yeah, you'll learn a lot about Japan and a lot about women and things like that. So,
Donna George Story, author of Amorous Woman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's hold the book up. That's a good idea. I'm gonna hold the book up. We're doing a little paparazzi moment.
Pause for the camera.
Jeez.
Talk, Terry.
All right.
Oh, wait.
Fill space.
Assist to fill the void. We're all, like, paused. Taking pictures as we're still live on the air.
Oh, here we go.
It's,
okay,
I'll explain
one more?
The book.
No, one more. Okay, so we're going to close the show. We're going to come back next Saturday night to Radio Suzy 1. I want to thank my special guest, Donna George Story, author of The Amorous Woman. Thank you. And Sister Terry. Thank you,
pleasure.
Sister Terry. And Brother Joe.
Absolutely, thank you.
Yes, thank you.
And thank you, all my darling listeners, wherever you are. I want you to be good, but if you're going to be good, you might even be better. If you're going to be bad, okay, bad, good. Make like bonobos, not baboons. Make love to someone you love tonight, even if that someone is you. I love you.